Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com.
Call them tamale pancake, stuffed masa frita, the humble love child of a quesadilla y calzone.
Welcome to Earth Eats, I'm Kate Young. Today on our show, we bring you a story from earlier this year featuring poet Willie Palomo talking pupusas and poetry with Earth Eats associate producer Alex Chambers. Harvest Public Media brings us a story about how the current trade war could lead to the revival of a Depression-era farmer assistance program you may have heard of, government cheese. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. First, Mark Chilla joins us with a couple of food news items that caught our attention this week. How's it going, Mark?
Hey, Kate. Great to be back in the news chair for just a moment. First up, we have a story from Taylor Killo. For months, the agricultural industry has been hopeful for new guest worker legislation, but disagreements about larger immigration reform keep getting in the way. It looks like this month is no different. In June, Republicans proposed an immigration bill that contained a new year-round H-2C visa, also known as Ag Act, that would allow immigrants to work for up to 3 years in U.S. agriculture. It would also allow them to change jobs if they wish. A later version of that bill omitted the year-round H-2C visa for farm workers programs altogether, coupled with a promise from House Republican leaders that ag guest worker legislation would be addressed this month. But a new report from Roll Call suggests that promise will be delayed once again. U.S. farmers rely on about 2 million ag guest workers each year, and some estimate around half of them are undocumented. Currently, ag guest workers can apply for an H-2A visa to work in the U.S., though their stay is for only one season and doesn't allow them to change jobs if they need to. Many farmers think the H-2A program is also lacking. According to the Farm Bureau, 72% of farmers and growers reported that workers arrive on average 22 days after the date of need. The H-2A program also provides less than 4% of the hired workers needed in agriculture. Our next story comes from Chad Bouchard. President Donald Trump this week nominated Dow DuPont executive Scott Hutchins to become the lead scientist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Hutchins is currently the global leader of integrated field sciences at Corteva Agriscience, the agriculture division of the recently merged Dow DuPont. Hutchins is an Indiana native with a PhD in entomology who serves as an adjunct professor at the University of Nebraska. If the Senate confirms him as Undersecretary for Research, Education, and Economics, the move will mark the third USDA posting under Trump with strong ties to Dow's pesticide and seed division. Dow Chemical donated $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee after the election in 2016. In April, the White House named Dow veteran Ken Isley as head of the USDA's Foreign Agriculture Service. In October of last year, the Senate confirmed former Dow lobbyist Ted McKinney as Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agriculture Affairs. Winona Howder, executive director of the environmental advocacy group Food and Water Watch, said in a statement that the move, quote, represents the interests of industrial agriculture in growing their bottom lines. Their payday will come at a cost to farmers, farm workers, and the environment, and will result in more dangerous toxins in our food, end quote. She also called for the Senate to block the nomination, calling it, quote, a particularly egregious gift to the chemical industry that imperils our food system from field to plate, end quote.
And thank you, Mark Chilla, for bringing us the news.
No problem, Kate. Happy to help out.
Trade disputes with China, Mexico, and Canada threaten to slash U.S. food exports by billions. President Trump has promised to protect farmers from trade war fallout, but how the administration would do that isn't clear. As Frank Morris reports for Harvest Public Media, it will likely involve an infusion of taxpayer money and the same agency that gave the world government cheese.
Out in the Kansas Flint Hills, farmer Glenn Bronco is fixing a haymow that's hit some rocks. Bronco is facing a rocky patch himself because the value of the corn and soybeans he's growing has nosedived since President Trump launched a trade dispute with China.
Prices are really bad. We're looking at some of the lowest prices we've had in quite a while, a decade or more.
Soybeans have plunged about 20%, corn about 15%. Mostly on the threat of tariffs. Farmers love free trade, and exports are crucial. About half the soybean crop goes overseas, most of that to China. It's a lucrative but fragile system, and Bronco says if China slaps new tariffs on soybeans and other row crops, some farms will fail.
This could be catastrophic. We could see a lot of producers not make it through to past this fall.
Midwestern farmers voted heavily for Donald Trump in 2016, despite his protectionist bent. And this spring, Trump made farmers a promise.
And we'll make it up to them. And in the end, they're going to be much stronger than they are right now.
The federal government already shores up farmers in lots of ways. Taxpayers subsidize crop insurance and other programs designed to compensate for natural disasters or falling prices. But Chad Hart at Iowa State University says the normal farm safety net won't protect farmers from the devastation of a trade war. He thinks the administration will dust off an old model for boosting prices, one that generated headlines and punchlines in the 1970s.
The government cheese program. Dairy prices were very low. The government was trying to support dairy farmers. The way they did that was by purchasing milk. They did it through this Commodity Credit Corporation.
The Commodity Credit Corporation came out of the Great Depression. Hart thinks the Trump administration is going to ramp it up now.
This is a relatively old program that sits in the shadows until it's needed for something like this.
Hart says the CCC can borrow up to about $30 billion. Joe Glauber with the International Food Policy Research Institute says it's not clear whether the USDA would use that money to buy up farm commodities or find a way to just pay farmers directly. Either way, Glauber says taxpayers are on the hook.
As a consumer, I'm going to have to pay higher prices because of this, and on top of it, higher taxes because of a bailout through the CCC Charter Act.
Trade disputes are already costing U.S. hog farmers hundreds of millions of dollars in sales. Crop farmers aren't really feeling it yet. This time of year, they're busy growing stuff, not selling it. But if trade barriers persist, Glauber says the pain could soon be very real.
I think U.S. agriculture has a much, much bigger problem if you lose a big share of these markets just because of a trade war that spirals out of control for a while.
Back on the farm, Glenn Bronco worries about the very same thing. Long-term damage to vital trading relationships, depressing commodity prices. Restoring free trade soon could make the difference between a bad year and a bad era, one potentially costly for taxpayers and brutal for American farmers. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Frank Morris.
Find more from our Harvest Public Media partners at harvestpublicmedia.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, moving its local branch to 1155 College Mall Road in August. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner's CFP and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And now we go to a story from Earth Eats associate producer, Alex Chambers.
Hey, Kate. So, a few weeks ago, I met a poet.
My name's Willie Palomo.
Who taught me to make pupusas. Pupusas are El Salvador's national dish. The country even got the Central American Free Trade Agreement to give them the corner on the pupusa export market. So they have a lot to do with identity for El Salvador, and for Willie, too, whose identity is complicated.
I grew up Mormon and Salvadoran, liking hip-hop in a suburb of Utah, so that's like a weird place to be.
And maybe contributed to the teenage identity crisis that led him to poetry. But we'll get to that. First, pupusas. How to describe them? You might call them a sort of a corn griddle cake.
Call them tamale pancake, stuffed masa frita, the humble love child of a quesadilla y calzone. The Spanish couldn't pronounce.
You could also just say they're tortillas filled with cheese and pork and beans.
So it's like a stealth tortilla?
Yeah, a stealth tortilla.
And traditionally, you eat the pupusas with curtido on top, and curtido is this topping that's made out of chopped cabbage, carrots. Some people throw other vegetables like beets or something in there. And then you also grind up tomatoes and then throw some seasoning in that, and then you end up with salsa. So you usually put those toppings on the pupusas, and traditionally you eat it with your hands.
The curtido needs time to pickle, so we decided to start with that.
What traditionally you do is like grab a whole head of cabbage, grab some carrots, and you'd slice them up. And some people put beets along with it. But what I did was just buy coleslaw from the grocery store, like raw. And then I'm just going to throw it into a bowl right now.
Onions? Are there onions in there?
Yeah.
So, cabbage, carrots, onions, maybe some beets. Slice them all into a bowl. Throw in some oregano and black pepper. Fill it about halfway with apple cider vinegar and top the rest up with water.
Traditionally, the way you make this, you actually let it soak into vinegar and water for a day.
But in our case, it would just be the couple of hours it would take to make the pupusas themselves. While the curtido sat, we got going on the pupusa filling.
So I got some pork loin chop cut thin from Kroger. And what we're going to do with it is cut it in smaller pieces right now. And then we're going to season it with some adobo. And like adobo is just like Latin mama's secret.
Which is, to give the secret away, sorry Willie, a dry seasoning mix that you can also get at Kroger.
And what we're going to do is fry the pork up until it's a little bit goldenish. And then we're going to mix it with some tomatoes and with some onions in a food processor. So looking at the pork right now, this looks like it's about done. So now that the pork is all done, I'm going to move to the food processor and put all the pork in there. We're going to grind it up with some tomatoes and onions. So let's see. We're going to chop up 2 onions.
3 tomatoes, then throw in some adobo.
Yeah, and you essentially want to grind it up into it's a bit pasty. The reason being is this is what's going to end up going inside the pupusas.
With the pork all done, we made masa, that dough made of masa harina and water you use to make tortillas. Willie filled his mixing bowl about halfway with masa harina and then poured in some water and started to mix it up with his hands.
It's really about getting the right sort of feel.
Kind of like, is like Play-Doh? Is that kind of what you're going for?
Yeah, Play-Doh is what you're going for.
So, we had our masa Play-Doh, which smelled like fresh tortillas, and our blend of pork and tomatoes and onions. Now we needed something rich to pull it all together.
I bought 2 queso frescos, and then I'm going to mix probably like 2 bags of mozzarella cheese with it. The reason mozzarella cheese works well is because what's delicious about pupusas is that the cheesy ones, like you're biting into it and like the cheese stretches as you're eating them. So that's always a delightful part of it.
And at last, the fillings were ground up and ready. The curtido was pickling and the masa was waiting. It was finally time to make pupusas.
Yeah, so now we're at the point where we can actually start preparing it. What I have right now is the masa, so you want to grab the masa, and you want to make a small kind of
ball in, of it in your hand. So you roll them out between your hands.
And how would you? What? How big would you describe that ball?
It kind of depends on how big your hands are, I guess. But like mine is, how big would this be? That's like a little bit bigger than a golf ball, right?
Yeah, I'd say.
I don't play golf. It would be like, if it's the size of an apple, it's too big.
Okay.
This is like a kiwi size. And then you, so once you get the ball, you flatten it between your hands by just smacking your hands together. And then once you get a flattened kind of tortilla, like roundish tortilla like shape in your hand, you grab a small fingerful of the pork and you put it in. And then you grab about the same amount of cheese and you put it into the center of the pupusa. So like the tortilla-ish part. And then once you have it all in there, kind of like it's a flour, you put the edges of the tortilla up. And this is kind of the hardest part to explain. And then you make sure it's all closed in. So what it looks like right now is like a ball again, because I closed everything up. And then I'm just rolling that between my hands. And then what we're going to do is flatten this ball again. And then what ends up happening is that it ends up looking flat like a tortilla again. So now I'm just placing it onto the pan. That's quite a bit bigger one. Yes, because you want to be able to cook more than one at once, or else it is just like, it already takes such a long time. You want to be able to speed up the process a little bit. And then like the way my mom grew up making these was over leña, which is like kind of an open flame stove where you like stick wood and stuff like that. I was in El Salvador this past summer and hearing some stories just about my grandma and stuff like that, and apparently she would like wake up at 3 a.m, kill a pig or two, have it cut up and all butchered, then make the first bit of it, which was like the fritada, which is like fried pork, and then like sell pieces of those off, and then like send my mom and her sisters to go sell, and then she'd make another thing that you can make out of pork, and then by noon she would be making pupusas. And this was in the context of a story of my grandma being like a badass and like how much work she would get done making all this stuff. So it's kind of an involved process to make the pupusas. I expect to be here for another little bit to end up with a decent batch.
Yeah, it was another little bit. I put down the mic to help Willie out. After a while, the kitchen was hazy with smoke from the griddle, and we had a good stack of pupusas. I figured we were close to done. And then I saw the mountains of ground pork and cheese looming over us on the counter, and I decided to make peace with being there all night. I mean, Willie's a good guy to hang out with, but I was getting hungry. Luckily, around the time the fire alarm went off...
It is kind of normal if your fire alarm goes off.
Willie suggested we take a break and eat. I was relieved. We each took a couple pupusas, piled on the cortito, and dug in. They were really satisfying. Salty from the pork, bright with the cortito's acid, and rich with the queso and mozzarella. As Willie pointed out, they're a good dish for a big gathering. He sometimes makes them with a friend for the free dinners at La Casa, the Latino Cultural Center at Indiana University. Historically, though, the labor of making these didn't usually fall to the guys.
The pupusas are traditionally made by, like, the woman in the culture. There's definitely something weird that, like, I'm a guy who makes pupusas. And, like, when I go back to El Salvador, they're like, you go in the kitchen with your mom and you, like, make pupusas with her? Like, growing up, like, as kids, we, like, my mom would let us play with the masa. And, like, of course we wanted to. It was like Play-Doh. We were like, ah. And my dad used to get mad and then be like, no, like, you guys, like, especially the boys, aren't supposed to be making pupusas.
I wonder what his dad thought about him becoming a poet.
My father used to slap my hands for squeezing maseca like Play-Doh. Making pupusas is a woman's work. Call me a maricón.
As we're talking and I'm trying to understand what it is about writing poems that's connected to pupusas, suddenly, like that moment when the dry powder of the masa harina coheres into a Play-Doh-y paste, it starts to come together. I realized that what got him started making pupusas must be the same as what made him a writer.
That definitely is. Like, I'm the one in my family who's been the most curious and the one who's been, like, the most trying to preserve. And I guess the one who had the biggest identity crisis, honestly, who, like, had the hardest time trying to grapple with, like,
who the heck I was. And what that drew me to was like exploring my culture more and actually being the one who asked my mom and dad the most questions. What I'm trying to get at right now is that, like, especially with a lot of Salvadoran parents who are in the U.S., of my generation at least, they came here because they were refugees of a civil war.
The Salvadoran Civil War, which started, officially at least, with a military coup in 1979. Throughout the 1980s, the government terrorized the civilian population with threats, disappearances, and publicized killings of anyone opposing them, including students, journalists, peasants, clergy, medical workers. The death squads ramped up their activity in the early 90s, until peace accords finally ended the war in 1992. Out of a population of just over 5 million, more than a million people were displaced.
There's huge experiences with migration, with warfare that they've had that, like, at least the way my parents approach it, like, never really talked to us about it as kids. Like, every once in a while, maybe a Christmas, while all the aunties were together, they'd tell stories late into the night. Or there's, like, bits and pieces of it that we would have. But, like, there was a certain point where I was just like, yo, mom, tell me this stuff. And that became crucially important, just because there was so much there that wasn't told. Talk to my mom about it. We had like a few moments like this where I was like, oh, why didn't you tell me this stuff? Initially, the first time I asked her that was when I visited El Salvador for the first time. I was like 18. And then I like land in El Salvador and like have this huge cultural adjusting and trying to figure out what's going on. Loved it the whole time I was there. But there was also a part of me that was hugely frustrated that my parents didn't share that with me earlier. We were going to bed. It was late at night. And then me and my mom were still awake. So, like, yes, out of nowhere, I was like, yo, mom, why didn't you tell me any of this stuff growing up? And, like, she was silent. She didn't say anything. So the next year when we go back to El Salvador, one of my tías is there with us again. So in the room when I initially asked the question was one of my tías, my mom, and me. And, like, my tía's there again, and we're talking. And I was like, yo, mom, remember last year when I asked you, like, why you didn't tell me anything and you didn't even answer me? And then my mom's like, yeah, I just got this knot in my throat, and I couldn't speak. And then my tía's like, Willie, you're so dumb. Of course your mom couldn't communicate an entire country to you. Like, that's ridiculous. And, like, once you're there, it's like, yeah, this would be really hard to communicate to, like, a kid who grew up only in the U.S. Like, when I was younger, I didn't even want to speak Spanish. And it wasn't until I was back in, like, late high school where I was trying to, like, figure that out more. So, like, a lot of that was just impossible to communicate. And especially when it came to the stuff about war, when I started talking to her about it, she was like, yeah, I wasn't going to tell you that stuff when you guys were kids. But to tell you, like, this traumatizing thing, I'm like, I'm worried to mess with you or something like that. So a lot of it was waiting until we were old enough that my mother was comfortable, like, sharing experiences she had with warfare and stuff like that. And, like, part of that, yes, desire and wanting to, like, know is what kind of also brought me to the pupusas and being like, oh, I want to know how to actually make this.
The Civil War sent Willie's parents and his tías and tíos and lots of other Salvadoran families into what would turn into the Salvadoran diaspora. They settled all over the states, from New Jersey to Salt Lake City. They kept their country alive through music and family gatherings and trying to keep their sons out of the kitchen. El Salvador became more than a country bordered by Guatemala and Honduras. It spread out.
It's what a lot of migration, that's what a lot of being a refugee is being uprooted and moved different places.
But then the sons and daughters moved to Indiana, and they want to know how much adobo to put into their pupusas. There's a recipe for pupusas available on our website. I cobbled it together based on the guesses about measurements Willie was giving me, just like the ones he got from his mother.
And then right now I think I'm throwing in like 2 to 3 teaspoons. And so, like, one thing that's really annoying with a lot of Central American cooking for, like, a lot of the children of the diaspora, so our parents who come from, like, El Salvador or elsewhere, is that, like, our parents don't cook using measuring, like, cups at all. So, like, when we, like, ask them, how do we make this? They never have a straight answer. They're like, oh, you just kind of put this much in. And you're like, how much was that? And they, like, have no idea.
But maybe it doesn't matter if the pupusas are somehow authentically Salvadoran or if they're the pizza pupusas Willie came across in Salt Lake City once. I think it's fine if your proportions of adobo to pork aren't exactly right. Willie doesn't live on the land where his parents or abuelitas did. But But some rough estimation of the place is still in his hands and in his mixing bowls and the food processor and in what he makes for his family and his friends.
The thing to keep in mind is that it doesn't need to be perfect, and especially the whole part about getting them just flat enough or just thin enough or, yes, without any holes in it is mostly aesthetic. So even those first batches of pupusas I had, like, tasted good, even though that they were, like, hideous and kind of deformed in all their different ways.
Pupusas o lucha. They look like tortillas, and Yankees can't tell the difference entre Mexicano y Huanaco entrees como accents y pimienta. Call them tamale pancakes, stuffed masa frita, the humble love child of a quesadilla y calzone. The Spanish couldn't pronounce popotlax either. What we called pupusas before we forgot to add the taste of nahua y libertad. Take a knife to my skin if you want to see what we're made of. But real Huanacos, we ain't afraid to get our hands dirty. I stink loco with Loroco's reefer. Slap and massage masa until it's ass fat. My father used to slap my hands for squeezing maseca like Play-Doh. Making pupusas is a woman's work. Call me a maricón. Once he threw out an entire batch porque la salsa no era auténtico. Whatever. Now you can find pizza pupusas y pupusas from SLC. Now I smack fried chicken like God's son into la masa and watch it pop y tremble campero into a baseline of humo y fuego. Call them what you like. As for me, I'll call them domingos where dinner set off fire alarms and the entire house smoked with mantequilla. I'll call them midnights mama stayed up to make enough to pay off debt collectors the way we gave our best to survive and fill our children's bellies, leaving them all licking their lips.
Thanks to Alex Chambers for that story. You can see photos of pupusa making in action, find the recipes so you can make these tonight, which is what I plan to do. It's all on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, moving its local branch to 1155 College Mall Road in August. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters. A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. Thanks to everyone who works on our show, including Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, all the folks at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Willie Palomo. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and that's it for Earth Eats this week. See you next time.